Welcome. Everyone can hear me? Perfect. All right. Welcome to what I hope. I know you can't see us because we're nice and low down here, but hopefully to be actually a really great discussion. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm Julia White, and I am the Corporate Vice President in Azure, in our marketing, the business side of things. And I'm really pleased to be joined by Kurt Delbene, who I had the pleasure of working with and for part of my career. But Kurt is actually, we were just doing the math up here, I've been in Microsoft for 25 years, joined the company on the Windows business, and then from there into the Office business and really birthed what is, you know, SharePoint among lots of other things. And then was leading the helm when we moved into Office 365.
Yeah, that's right.
So helping with our cloud journey when I had the pleasure of working for you during that time period.
Was it a pleasure?
What was that?
Was it a pleasure?
It was a pleasure. Always a pleasure, Kurt.
you just never know.
I'm not just saying that, really. And then you had the very interesting opportunity to actually leave Microsoft for a short period of time, where I remember you retired, and we did retirement videos for you, but that was all lies.
Yes.
Because you turned up and worked actually in the Obama administration on healthcare.gov.
I did.
And that initiative there. And then we had the great fortune of having you return to Microsoft in your current job, which you win the longest title ever, which is the Chief Digital Officer and Executive Vice President of the
Core Services Engineering and Operations.
I'm not and Corporate Strategy.
Not into that whole brevity thing.
No, you're like all those words. I only know the acronyms, which is why I had to ask what it actually stands for, because it's too long to speak, but that is what you do now. So let me turn it over to you for just a second to a little bit about you and your career.
Yeah, so I started in product development. I've been a product developer most of my life. Actually, my education is all in operations research, so I'm a math geek. But worked at Bell Labs and then came to Microsoft and came up through development ranks most of my time in Office. So I ended up leading Office as the president of the Office division. And then healthcare.gov crashed. And my wife, who's actually a member of Congress, we were sitting at the breakfast table, and I was reading the New York Times article, and I said, it's really clear as to why this thing crashed. And she then said, well, would you be willing to help? And I was leaving Microsoft to figure out what else I could do with my life. And I said, sure. And literally within a couple weeks, takes a little time, I was sitting in the Oval Office talking to the president, and he says, I unabashedly beg you to do this. And I learned afterwards that you don't actually go into the Oval Office unless you're ready to say yes.
Oh, interesting.
And so fortunately, I was willing to say yes. And so I spent about 7 months with a very talented set of people who turned around healthcare.gov. So I was kind of the president's guy and briefed him, was a member of the team kind of driving that, but briefed him in the Roosevelt Room once a week. And so I spent about 7 months doing that. When they got it back on track, or we got it back on track, going into the next season, when everything was on track, I left and came back to Microsoft. So Satya originally wanted me to, or I came up back leading corporate strategy, because I kind of know the company left to right pretty well after 25 years. And then he came to me about a year and a half ago now, saying, we're a pretty old company in terms of our core systems. We're pretty fresh in terms of being a tech company. I want to embody digital transformation in how we run the internal processes of the company, so that we can be a model or feel proud of the way we do digital transformation and talk about it to customers. So he asked me to lead both IT and business operations. So how we transact all the enterprise agreements worldwide, that's part of my team, as well as traditional IT. And so that's what we now call Core Services Engineering and Operations. We used to call it MSIT, and it's kind of a reflection of, we think it is core services. There's not a difference between us and the Azure team, except for they run products to sell externally. We run all the business processes that drive the success of Microsoft.
Got it. Fantastic. Now, just starting with you for just a second, then we're going to talk obviously about the transformation you're driving across the company. Now, you are Chief Digital Officer. You're not a CIO, you're not a CEO. You have that title. What does that mean, and what's the mindset you have with that approach?
Well, when I took over the role, we actually did have a CIO, very talented CIO, Jim Dubois. But I had to figure out what is it, you know, Satya basically said, digitally transform our processes. And he didn't give me a lot more suggestions to what to do. And so I actually kind of took a systematic look at it and said, well, what are the processes that we run the company based on? And I said, okay, there's 16 core processes we run the company based on. If you're going to be cynical about it, you say, all I know is product development, so I'm going to take a product development point of view on it. and say there ought to be a core vision for each one of those processes that we think about is like, what's this trying to enable? What does it mean for Microsoft to be digital end-to-end in terms of our transactioning engines? What are we trying to accomplish? So define the vision, define a release roadmap, again, just like a product team, define metrics we're going to measure success on. And so for me, the being chief digital officer is about taking the notion that there are new digital technologies which can fundamentally transform how you work and to infuse those into a vision of how those core processes should run in the company. And so that's what we've been trying to do.
Got it. Now, most people know Microsoft, and especially here, about our products and our cutting edge innovation we're releasing out to our customers.
Yeah.
But the area you run is what's 40 years old.
Yep.
The inside guts of the organization. And so I would love to unpack what you've had to do from what we have today, the org part of it, the technology part of it, and to move us into this digital first approach to that. So let's break that down a little bit.
Yeah, so the first thing, I mean, people think Microsoft's a modern company, we must have modern digital processes, and that is pretty far from the truth. A bunch of you probably have had enterprise agreements from Microsoft.
Or the way we license our technology.
Seen an enterprise agreement? Well, there are some that actually, if you think about the different ways that you can purchase Azure, can be hundreds of pages long because of the way our systems are built. They don't have the agility to say, oh, if you buy Azure this way in this geography, it's just an algorithm that says how much you should pay for that. You know this well, leading marketing for Azure. And so we have these pretty crufty old systems, and they get embodied in these, you know, it's like anytime you want to do an enterprise agreement, you crack open a new pen and you start writing. And so it's funny, Amy Hood, when I took the job, she says, oh, you got to go to the ROCs, the regional operating centers, and see all the paper. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to the ROCs. And we have three of them. We have one in Singapore, one in Reno, and we have one in Dublin. And I went to the ROCs, and I started looking for all the paper. And it turns out there's no paper anywhere. So I said, wow, Amy's just out of touch. She doesn't realize that there's no paper. Amy Hood, our CFO. We've fully modernized. We're all set.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out what we've done is we've had our licensing executives scan everything into PDFs, and everything gets transmitted to us, but it's really just a physical document. So that's kind of the state of some of our digital processes as they exist. So part of what we've done is to say, we're going to go digital end-to-end from the point where you start interacting with Microsoft as a customer to purchase, to understanding what you've already purchased, to transacting from Microsoft, to seeing how everything's doing going from customer support.
Okay.
That entire process is going to be modern and digital. Mm-hmm. And so we brought folks together across the company in that particular area, and that's one of 16 such places.
Okay.
We said, we're going to have a vision, we're going to take all of the people that are stakeholders in that vision, and we're going to bring them all together into a room, we're going to say, this is where we're taking this, does that comport with what your view is?
Okay.
And in a lot of cases, the interesting thing, and I think this is something for IT overall, getting all the stakeholders in the one, getting everybody in the room on a regular basis and saying, this is where we're taking things. Hmm. Having a point of view about not just saying, what can we do for you, but rather we're going to get out in front of it and say, this is how we think we should transact in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then having them react to that, you get out of this world where you are, you know, an order taker for this, for what you want the service to be. You're now telling them, this is what we think the right answer is. Tell me whether you agree or not. And in this particular one, it's interesting that we actually had a modernization plan. And in the very first meeting, I still remember that your boss, Takeshi, says, actually, for several months, we haven't agreed with this plan. And nobody said anything because there's such momentum in the industry around a particular area of saying, this is where we're going. And so it allows people to say, that does not compose with my worldview. We get together, we solve the problem together, and everybody is now, we have had the longest period of having a single modernization plan in commerce as a result. So that's kind of on the business side. And so imagine in every big area that you're working in, you set a vision, you bring in the stakeholders, and you say, you iron it out and say, this is what you need. And then they come in with their laundry list.
Yeah.
And you say, well, let's talk about the relative priorities of what you want to get done with the vision of where we want to take things. It's just like building a product again.
Yeah.
So then there's a bunch of stuff on the cultural side that has to change as a result of that as well.
For sure. But getting to that, I know one of the things you and I have talked about over the few months of really running this organization like a traditional Microsoft product team, which you have lots of experience doing, thankfully.
Yep.
But bringing it in and, you know, start talking about the vision and how you drive requirements and having subject matter expertise versus just what does the business need to take orders. So, like, I know that's been a big part of the new leadership you brought. So just, I'd love to hear more about that aspect of it.
Yeah, it is. It is a product. I mean, people say, it's funny, I came over from Office and everybody's like, oh, here's the Office guy. He's just going to make us look just like Office. And I still have this transgression that, in fact, I was in a meeting earlier today where I said, well, the way we used to do it in Office is, eh. And like, people are just tired of hearing it. But it actually, the parallels to thinking about the business processes as a product are very, very tight. Mm-hmm. And and the way that I talk about it in a lot of cases is, one, we're going to be vision-led. Okay. Everything we're going to do is going to be driven based on a vision where we want to take things. If something doesn't comport to the vision, then maybe we ought not to be doing it.
Okay.
So that is very clarifying. And then the other phrase that comes up over and again is the process is the product. Hmm. And so if you think about it that way, even what we do in operations is a product they're shipping. The end-to-end how I transact, the end-to-end how I stay compliant, that's really just a product. And launch is a product even for us. The way we launch new products into the market is a product. The way we launch business changes, in like if you guys in Azure decide that there's a new way that we should license Azure or do compliance around Azure, we have a launch team. And that launch team says we're going to launch that product, and even despite that, it's a business process. And so that getting into that rhythm, and it really, as I said, is very clarifying, saying we're going to stop doing this and we're going to do this. I'll tell you, it even goes down to our networking team.
Really?
So we have one called the core platform team underneath, is directly underneath me. And I met with the networking guys. Mm-hmm. I said, and I remember the first conversation. I said, how do you think about when we should change out our routers?
Okay.
And he said, every 3 years we go through a product cycle and we change out our routers. I said, well, what's your aspiration for our network? And what do you try? And nobody had asked him that question before.
Really?
And I said, well, you must have some vision about where you want to take your network. And he said, well, actually, we do. We want to actually get, we think that the best thing from a security performance perspective and performance perspective is to remove the internet.
Okay.
That it's nothing but it slows things down. Once somebody gets into the internet, they can go laterally left and right, and it's a security vulnerability. And so we have this idea called Internet First. I'm sure we're not the only people who have got it, but we're actually going to slowly collapse our internet into only the things that can't live without being directly connected, and then we want to get rid of that too.
Got it.
So even it's no matter what area that you thought could not be a product, you can still think about it as a product.
Got it. So it's really that mindset that you brought consistently.
It is.
Now, you know, part of the mindset that was there, I think, because the product teams like myself and others would come and be like, we need this, which I'm sure many people in this room can relate to. Like, here's my business requirements.
Yes.
But how, so you can change, but how did you also drive change in the stakeholder system to make that dynamic different?
That's still a work in progress. So I'll tell you one area where we continue to need to drive faster as an internal team is we have this great tool, Dynamics CRM, and yet when the history of how it got used at Microsoft is everybody came to us and said, we want another report. And by the way, we're going to write the reports ourselves and just you tell us how to bolt them into the infrastructure that you have, that is what our internal tool is called MSX.
Okay.
And so that created this world that says we've got, you know, the performance issues on some of these reports. You can create reports that do in Power BI that are not particularly performant.
Yeah.
We got all this legacy and this debt. We need to step back and say, what are the personas of the people that are going to use this tool, just like you do, you know, in the development teams.
Yep.
What's the overall vision? What are the personas that are going to use the tools? What is the priority of the workflows that they need to go through? And then you have to bring it all together. There's like multiple personas. At one point, they defined 31 different personas. That's going a little extreme. But there's like six different personas, and you have to kind of balance out what are you trying to accomplish? What are the features that will actually provide capability across multiple ones
of
those personas so you get more leverage?
Got it.
But to your question directly, it's a different way for the stakeholders to think about what you're providing them. Mm. And they also, when they come to you and say, we just need this one extra report, you have to step back with them and say, wait, what are we trying to accomplish? Yeah. Where is this in our relative priority? Mm-hmm. And this was what we had at healthcare.gov as well. We had this exact same issue, where we had 50 different priority one issues or things that we needed to do.
Right.
And here's a team that actually hasn't shipped a working website. And you're still dealing with all these different things, everything's P1. And so we instituted something called radical prioritization, where there's basically can be only one priority one.
Got it.
There can be only one priority two. Uh-huh. And you don't actually work on the second priority until you've sure that the team is executed on the first one.
Got it.
And so the stakeholders, if they see that there's a clear prioritization and you're being consistent with that, will actually give you the space to compromise, where you don't have it if they just come at you with a bazillion different priorities.
Got it. I like that radical prioritization.
Yeah.
I'm gonna remember that. Use that on my team when I need it. now, there's been in the industry, but also I think at Microsoft too, this kind of where does IT sit centrally? Does it sit with the business team? Is that push-pull? Really interested in your perspective, both what you've learned, but also what you see and kind of how it works.
Right. So one of the things that when I took the job, I said, let's figure out the model for how other organizations like us organize the IT function, the operations function. And it turns out there are multiple models. There's the model that everything is centralized, and then there's the model that says there is no IT whatsoever. There aren't actually very many companies like that, but there are some that have grown up from a tech perspective where they say every single product team just also builds a nugget of what our internal infrastructure is. Mm-hmm. And so we saw that you could do it one way or the other. We actually centralize a bunch of it, and it actually gives you that credibility to be the partner with the business. But then you also have to be a good partner, basically saying, again, going proactively and saying, I have a vision, does this compose with you, et cetera. And so we've gone towards more of a centralized model, but we still have partnerships, like the new modern stack is actually done in Scott Guthrie's world. Okay. And so pieces that are close to the business, they end up being in the business.
Okay.
But we have this very tight relationship with them so that we work things out together. So it generally works pretty well. The thing I think is interesting is in a world where digital transformation is core to every business, and every business is a software business, then what you wrestle with, and I've heard from a lot of CIOs, is, well, so-and-so an organization wants to build a software function within their organization.
Right.
And even the chief digital officer can be another part of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's tricky because if you think about it, if you can show credibility that your team can build products, deliver products, and actually address the end user needs and the product needs, then you can actually build a very strong software development capability within your organization does both the centralized core services, but also builds the software for those products.
Yeah.
But you have to develop that credibility. You have to change the way you're structured to be much more around how a dev team would be functionally aligned. There's a dev team. There's a program management team. You have to look like a product development team if you're going to get that product, that kind of credibility.
I think that's so interesting. I mean, all companies, Microsoft, we obviously have our products are technology, so our developers are in every business group. We could be completely distributed from a central systems perspective, but even at Microsoft, it really does have the affinity and makes sense to have this more central systems, which is mostly where we are, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's pivot to what you started talking about. You had to come in and you got as much information as digitally transform us.
Great. Right.
Thanks for that, boss. Great.
Yeah, exactly.
You had to come take your team and you transitioned it to run like a product team. So let's talk about that part of your team, like the structure, the mindset. Let's kind of walk through those pieces of it.
Yeah, so there's a few things you have to do. One, again, being vision-led is key. So you have to have the mentality that you're running like a product team. The second thing is you have to deal with how should you be structured.
Yeah.
And we have decided that we are a very functionally aligned organization. Underneath me, and this is the reason that we decided to go without a CIO. It's not that we're not against having a CIO, in fact. In fact, in the future, we could have a CIO. But I wanted to have those teams directly report to me. So I have like five major areas that directly report to me. And within each of those teams, they are functionally aligned, which means there is a software development team, a set of software engineers. There's a set of program managers. Mm-hmm. There is site reliability engineers as well.
Okay.
And the benefit there is if you start as a developer in my team, it's going to feel just like starting a developer in Azure. And by the way, the levels in the org and how you progress feels exactly the same.
Okay.
And so I think part of it is really getting functionally aligned. Part of it is getting into this vision discussion with the various stakeholders. Part of it is getting into the discipline of, like, we do site reliability reviews, and we do services reviews, and we do them on a monthly basis, and we walk through all the incidents. And we have everything that you'd see in a product development team. We have mirrored that because it fits in with the how we're thinking about it.
Got it.
The other thing we did, and it's a very controversial thing in IT organizations, is how you're funded. Mm. And the way it's worked, and I think it's very common for other parts of the org, is all your funding comes in from other organizations funding you.
Got it. So the business groups give the IT team.
Right. They say, okay, I'm going to give you $100 million or $50 million, and I want you to build this with it.
Mm-hmm.
That is a really difficult environment to live in.
Mm-hmm. Most people don't get $100 million.
I was going to say, it's all a matter of scale.
Yeah,
totally. Otherwise, $5 million. I'm sorry.
I should get your point,
it's
though.
It's the exact same question,
yes,
regardless of your scale.
Just kidding.
But the problem you run into, one, if you're one of those dev teams, they say, well, how do I budget how big I should be next time?
Right.
And so they say, I can't actually invest in people, and it actually gets you towards doing more outsourcing.
Mm.
And the problem with outsourcing, there's a number of issues with outsourcing,
yeah, we'll
but you can't, there's this reliability of how much can I bank on?
Yeah.
And so so that's one of the issues. The other issue is you're beholden to them. They don't just budget you to build my finance systems. They budget you to build a particular thing for them.
Mm.
And if you're going to be vision-led, you're basically going to them and saying, this is what we think we're going to build. And by the way, we've got to be the ones who ultimately kind of bring things together and decide what we're going to build.
Right. Otherwise, you're incredibly short-term oriented.
Exactly.
Because year to year, your budgets could change.
And the stuff you build, it's like a random report that some people convinced somebody in the organization was important enough to get funded.
For that year.
Right. The other thing you run into is if the HR team has a finite budget, yet the most important things to do as an organization are in HR this year, well, then you need to actually pull part funding from one part of the organization over to the other part, and you can't do that if your funding is stratified that way.
Got it.
So what we did was we got Amy on board, Amy Hood, to say, we're going to centralize all of our funding, and we're going to have a CSEO budget. Now, she's very hardcore in terms of keeping that lean and, kind of as a percentage of our overall spend, getting very disciplined there.
Yeah.
But then we get to decide where it goes, again, in concert with the stakeholders. And that's been a huge thing.
Got it.
The other thing we're doing is we're shifting the mix of resources away from contractors and more towards full times. Because this whole notion of outsourced development, there are very good outsourced SIs and ISVs, so it's really not a critique of them so much as you lose connection to them in terms of what your priorities are and what you're trying to build.
Got it.
And so, in fact, the contracting capabilities are designed to be that way. If we're going to outsource, build this for us, for them to actually not be employees of Microsoft, there has to be a certain distance between them and us. And yet that means there's a distance in terms of the processes that we build together. And we need these folks to be core developers. We need to have them think as great developers. And so we're shifting from being the more outsourced than insourced to be more full-time developers and fewer contractors. But all these come together around being, it's just the stamp and the way we act is much more like Office. It's much more like Azure, et cetera.
Got it. I mean, that's true. We don't outsource our core devs from Azure or Office. I can't imagine we'd ever do that. So
right.
That same mentality.
In fact, we had a Steven Sinofsky, who I learned a bunch of how to run Office from, used to say, if it's core to what you build, you don't outsource it.
Got it. You only
outsource the stuff that is a peripheral piece or it's something that's a surge thing that you expect to go away over. And we're trying to get that disciplined as well.
Yeah. But going back to kind of the route that got you there was around funding. Right,
yes.
And if you are, being product oriented, vision led, here's where we're going. Then, going and getting, tin cup money each year, and then having the inconsistency year over year would constantly undermine that. So
yes.
You took the approach of work directly with the CFO,
correct?
And sit there and say, this is how we're going to run it. Here's why. So I assume that took some work. But then, how did that exactly happen? And guidance of other people who said want to take a similar approach, just thoughts on that one.
Well, the first thing that happens is you get the pulse of the organization, and the thing that came up over and over and over again is that our funding approach was busted.
Okay.
And then we have our system at Microsoft, we have a pretty senior person in Amy's team that is directly my finance person.
Okay.
So Victor and I talked and said, this seems fundamentally broken.
Okay.
And we actually went together and said, well, maybe we ought to pitch that it should work a different way. And then we wanted to get our controller on board. So, and the person who is responsible, this is one thing, if you want to get it sold, first thing to do is get the finance person who defines what finance needs for software systems, get him or her on board. And so we got Frank Brode on board. He begrudgingly said, okay, this funding model will work.
I see.
And then we talked to Amy about it and got it set up. You know, and then we did it on a fiscal year boundary.
Uh-huh.
It was too much to actually just kind of recast everything.
Sure.
But even then, you get a certain confidence because you know that it's going to change the fiscal year boundary that you can start spending in a different way.
Got it. So you started by establishing with your peers that this was a root problem.
Yes.
That if we wanted better internal, if we wanted to do our own digital transformation, this was a necessary change.
Right.
And then went through the smart tactics of getting that implemented
and
in that way.
We're a pretty collaborative bunch at Microsoft.
Sure.
And so if you come to them with a logical argument as to why you need it, then you also have to deliver for them, right?
Right.
You have to deliver on the priorities. I actually think you deliver better on the priorities if you're clear on what your North Star is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helped as well.
Now, and a key, I think, you know, delivering on that and making sure people see the value at it. One of the things you guys have embraced is this idea of, you know, first party, third party, really using our own technology in such that we can be our best customers and then give that feedback back to the product team. So interested in that part of what you do and how you think about it.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. First, we are, and we know the stats deeply, we are 95% on Azure now.
Got it.
And so
statement of all Microsoft
internal
systems.
That is a statement of all the business processes that run Microsoft are now 95% of them are running it. And that also includes our SAP instance.
Which is
massive.
And
we are one of the largest SAP instances in the world.
Got it.
And so we're running wholly on Azure today. We actually have the system running on premises, but all it is getting logs shipped to it so that we can track the consistency. The one in Azure is our master.
Primary.
And this is really just kind of a dupe until we decide to shut it off.
Got it.
So we deeply embraced Azure.
Mm-hmm.
We actually, by virtue of doing that, we have helped the Azure team build a bunch of the reporting tools, et cetera, that allow us to see, are we spending effectively? How can we reduce our spend? We think we're saving somewhere around 10 to 20% of our overall cost by running on Azure instead of running on premises.
Mm-hmm.
There's a different security footprint as a result because you're not thinking about, again, you've got this massive intranet that you're trying to guard against. And as I said, we will eventually shrink that intranet down to something very small. But that was one example. It's like everything's going to be on Azure and we're going to drive cost savings from that. The other thing is we have, I think by being, again, focused on the vision, we've done that in every area, including what our desktop looks like.
Okay.
So we basically said, instead of the Windows guys saying, we want you to dog food this next, we basically say, actually, yeah, that's a great thing. We need that.
Mm-hmm.
And some stuff we say, no, actually, that doesn't compose with our view of our feature set that we need for our internal folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not going to help you dog food that. So go find a different customer for which that's something that's critical for them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Which is feedback in itself.
Exactly. Well, it is, true. And so another thing we've done is we've defined our vision in a big document that says this is where we're heading.
Yeah.
And now we've flipped that and said, what does it say about our product vision?
Mm.
And so we're actually taking the learnings there and getting them in a way that's very consumable by our product teams.
Yeah.
And so you can think about there's this flywheel that goes on of we define what our vision is. We then get our stakeholders to talk with us about refining that, but we also get the product teams. We give the feedback to the product teams. We get super real about, for instance, we're moving from SCCM to manage our desktops to moving everything to Intune.
Okay.
We now have a very clear roadmap of how we're going to do that over a period of time and what that deployment looks like at Microsoft. We've then given feedback to the Intune guys, Brad Anderson and team, of saying, we need these sub features. By the way, this feature doesn't work as well.
Mm.
And so we get it helps Microsoft's products get better, and we get this clear trajectory for where we're going as a result. So that, again, is this place where it refines the product strategy.
Mm.
And then the other thing we do is we consume a lot of third-party products as well.
Yeah.
And we make a very clear distinction about where we do one versus the other.
Okay.
And we, particularly in the biz app space,
yeah.
we talk with James Phillips and say, hey, We think this is a new opportunity to you. We're paying a third party a bunch of money for this. We think if you tweak these products in this way, that could be a first party product. Because everybody's trying to push us to say, use less third party, use more first party. There are places we can't do that, but there's also these in-between places where we can make our products better. And then be better for everybody to consume as well.
Got it. Can it be in that internal litmus test of things?
Again, everything hangs together better and it moves
One of the areas that I've been excited about is your push to get rid of passwords.
Yes.
Which is another good example of using our own technology, but also pushing things forward that then we can turn around and help our customers do too. So I'd love to, that one is you hadn't mentioned that one yet. I'd love to hear about that.
Right. So security is one of our areas. We think of it of how many people could articulate crisply what their strategy is in security. It's hard because you got inundated with a bazillion different product, and it's a little bit like a belt and suspenders model, right? So if I have a belt and suspenders, my pants are less likely to fall down. And so let's buy one of several things, and we'll just make sure that we've got, we call it defense in depth, but
it's not a fancy word for
really a belt and suspenders. But what we did is we said there are very specific things like identity, that are a core to our identity, telemetry, a number of things that are the core elements of our security posture.
Yeah.
And then within identity, how is it that we're going to actually reduce the threat that comes from identity? First, it's a recognition that the boundary of your internet is not the boundary anymore. It's all about who can get in and out based on identity. And then you look and you say, what's one of the biggest risks that you have? It's the fact that people have passwords.
Yeah.
And people have passwords that they write down. And then everybody decides that there's some manifestation of Seahawk that's a password. And it's true. If you search and you do a histogram of the passwords that are in use in your organization, there are going to be some that are highly, highly used.
Yeah.
And by the way, the culprits that are trying to get in know what those are.
Interesting.
And so the attackers are getting more and more sophisticated.
Sure.
So Brett Arsenault said that the goal here is there should never be a password.
Yeah.
And so we articulated a vision to get away from passwords. We then say, okay, what are the pieces that actually compose to get you there? And for me, at least, the penny dropped and said, well, the purpose of Hello is not to actually make it easier to log in, but to get you closer towards a point where you don't have passwords anymore.
Right. Hello.
Right. And so we're moving to a world where right now we require people to change their password, I think, every 3 months. We will get everybody towards biometrics as the way you log in. We actually track the percentage of our users that log in via some biometric ability as opposed to their passwords.
Yeah.
We will then go to machine-generated passwords, which will be long and cumbersome, but people will have to find some secure place to have those. And then we'll get to a point where you will only have to change that password once a year. Eventually, we'll get to the point where it'll all be certificate-based, and the only thing you'll log in is based on biometrics.
Got it.
And at that point, there are no passwords anymore. It's all based on certs that are passed around and biometric authentication.
Got it. Which is a topic we talk to our customers about all the time.
Totally. Right? It allows you to actually say, okay, all these things that you look at all the products that Microsoft's shipping, all the stuff that's in the security space, step back and say, what are the core foundations of what you're trying to do? And for us, it is identity as the perimeter. It's about great telemetry and what's going on in your network. And it's about information protection. And those are kind of the stool with the top of it being around great policy in place as well. And when we look to figure out how can we accomplish each of those in its best way.
Got it. So I want to go back for just a second because I realize we didn't touch on this one. You talked about going from more of an outsource model into an insource model.
Yeah.
So you're hiring a lot of new developers into this organization. And I was curious, are you looking for the profile that you would have hired into Windows or Office in your past life? Are you looking for a different profile? How are you thinking about that in terms of bringing devs in? Because a lot of customers I work with are doing similar. Like, I got to hire more devs and for this group of people. What are you looking for and what's the mindset you're looking to hire?
It's a good question. So we are hiring at a massive scale right now because of this transformation. Interesting, we're actually doing it in being revenue neutral or cost neutral.
Okay.
So everybody has embraced the notion that I will get rid of two outsourced people to hire one insource person. And that makes it revenue neutral for us.
Got it. Plus all the money you're saving by running on Azure, by the way.
We are. And actually, the other great thing, it's a good thing you pointed that out, if you own your own budget, you get to plow that savings back into some other investment, which is a great thing as well.
Yes.
So we're hiring traditional devs. Mm-hmm. We are also hiring new disciplines, like we now have a centralized user experience team and user design team and user research team. Mm-hmm. We have a centralized data team that basically says, how is our data structured across the organization? How do we create consistency? Mm-hmm. How do we build a platform so that on Azure that we can do machine learning against? Machine learning we are doing, it's infused across the company of like every place that you can think about being better in your decision making is a place that you can use machine learning. So we talked about it today in terms of what you might think as mundane things of like what is the flow of your support instances for your internal support. When is it likely to peak? Okay. What are the particular issues that you're going to get? Like we find that if you change somebody's password, there is a higher probability that a week later their remote access, they're going to call you up about remote access issues.
Got it.
And so there's all these predictive models that you can build. And so we're hiring a lot of data analysts and people who are data scientists to be able to do that modeling. The other thing we're learning is that we are a great gateway to other parts of Microsoft for developers. So we're also moving much more towards having a deep presence in university campuses so that we can hire people in younger in career. It changes the whole complexion of what your organization's like because you got a lot more young people running around with new ideas and with that energy. So we still have to hire a lot at all levels, but we're trying to build up our university recruiting.
Okay.
And then the final thing we're doing is trying to figure out alternative sources for talent, which we believe we can actually take people with a little less capability, but the right aptitude, and hire them with a little bit more training and give them an on-ramp towards towards a full-fledged dev job at Microsoft.
Got it.
So because if you do have all this demand, you got to come up with new sources.
Right. So, I think about the program we run with the military and training people who are leaving the military to bring them into
And we're going, the other thing is it helps with your diversity and inclusiveness questions around finding places that are, you don't recruit as much towards. We thought, wow, and are there places in Latin America we can recruit, especially if you think there's a set of kind of come in and do the base level education that they may not have gotten, at least contextually, in that they need in the United States. Like particular dev tools that we use, for instance, if smart people, we can bring them in.
Yep.
We can help there as well.
No, that's great. And so, I think in general, the growth and demand for development is so high, we're going to need to be more creative in how we think about it.
And if you think about it, once we show up to university recruiting and the university recruiting guys say, well, great, I've got the Azure guys that are trying to hire at a record pace. I've got the Office guys that are trying to hire at a record pace. Uh-huh. So we got to come up with diverse or different ways of getting it accomplished.
Got it. Okay, so now I'll go back to another thing you said, which was, my mic's recording here. You've now 95% running in Azure for internal systems.
Yep.
That didn't just happen overnight.
It didn't.
It didn't happen in one big chunk.
Yep.
So what did that look like and how you approached that migration? Top of mind for lots of people.
Yeah, so we did it in multiple stages. We said, one, this is the opportunity to actually just get rid of a bunch of systems that you have.
Okay.
And so the first thing we did is we did not choose to just take everything that we built and ship it over and put it in a VM in the cloud.
Okay.
We said, this is the opportunity to clean up, and we took a set of apps and said, we are going to sunset these things really fast.
Okay.
And so that cleaned up a bunch of cruft.
Now, how did you decide those were cruft?
We found out how many people logged into them.
And whether there's an alternative.
We just stats. We communicated to these folks and said, there are two people who use this system every month. We think we can provide you a different way. Or by the way, did you know there's already a different system that does exactly the same
interesting.
Thing?
You're the last two to figure that out.
Right. There's such propensity to never get rid of a system because you're sure somebody's going to squawk.
And so we basically, that's a cultural statement.
Yeah, it is. Okay. And so you basically do the telemetry, you find out which ones aren't being used very much, which one have alternatives, and you sunset a bunch of stuff.
So just what was the percentage, ballpark, of the
I think
systems?
It's like 20% of the total set of systems that we ultimately got to the point where we could basically just sunset.
Don't need them anymore.
And we're still killing a bunch of them. And that's like the 5% part of it is the stuff we're just trying to get rid of.
Got
and
it.
It's not eventually going to move. Then we took a set of things and said, which ones are we going to redesign? And there are certain things that are massively cheaper if you use a PaaS service instead of you just take this VM and ship it to the cloud. Mm. So imagine this thing, and healthcare.gov was like this as well, and they did a total on-premises deployment, which was wrong. The peakiness of that, of like, and you have it in earnings at Microsoft, that's a big piece of it, it just goes like this. Mm. And so what you want is the ability to surge up and down. Now you can do that by throttling the size of VMs and sleeping things as well. But what about those systems that you just never use except for the random transaction that comes in and that needs to be processed and put in, the data needs to be, you know, needs to kick off a workflow and the data needs to go in the right place.
Okay.
That is a perfect serverless application that you will save a ton of money if you just rebuild that application as a PaaS enabled application. So we took a bunch of ones and just said, these we're going to redesign. We've always wanted to redesign, and we're going to take this opportunity to do that.
Okay.
We took and the rest of them we took and said, these are probably going to continue to be VMs. We're going to take those VMs. We're going to move them up to the cloud, and we're going to do a prioritized view of which ones. Like, we had some that were running out of capacity on premises.
Okay.
We're going to go through the capital cycle again and said, those are the ones we want to move sooner.
Okay.
And so we then just did a prioritization and moved them over a period of time. The longest one to move, because we were early in the cycle of figuring out how to get it done, was SAP.
Okay.
And even there, though, and now we think we could do it in 18 months. The whole thing, soup to nuts, we could move in 18 months. But at that point, we said, let's start to move some of the SAP workloads over, and let's keep the core piece that is our transaction engine, our general ledger, and we'll keep that for last.
Okay.
And then in February of this year, we moved it over as well.
Got it. What did that take you from the beginning? Maybe one of the most
difficult ones. I think the actual movement of the last piece was about 3 months, 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
Yeah, from the time we started the actual move takes a weekend, or a week actually. But it, you know, all the planning for the core ledger and all, it took about 3 or 4 months.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know if you, when this started in the very beginning, but just from a ballpark of taking, you know, a lot of systems at Microsoft, obviously, to where you are now, what was that whole end-to-end time?
Well, again, Azure has evolved over a long period of time, but we've been at it about 3 years in total.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, early on, we're in partnership with Scott's teams of saying, you know, what does it take to do that, et cetera. And
Got
so
it.
It's not probably not a fair comparison.
Again,
I think if you took SAP as one example, you could move a large chunk of your infrastructure over in an 18-month period.
Got it. Okay. All right. One last area before we can open up for questions.
Yeah.
There's definitely a lot of sense of how do you get the ear of all the businesses and have kind of that relationship and that trust and that kind of ongoing approach so that the model you've created sustains. And so just interested in how you've accomplished that and what you have to invest to continue that.
I think, again, I do think this notion of being vision-led helps, because then they see the roadmap as opposed to all their people coming to them and saying, you know, I want this from you, and having people come to them as leaders and say, here's all the demands we have on the central organization.
Right.
And so it gives you that air cover to say, this is where we're going, and let us slot your priorities into that context of where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
I can't emphasize enough how important that is. The other thing that you have to do is you have to just deliver for them. And you have to set this product release roadmap. We've gone to all agile development.
Okay.
So basically, we run in sprints. Mm-hmm. Everybody understands, you know, there's going to be a 2 or 3 month sprint.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to deliver on that time frame. We're even working with how we do that in SAP.
Got it.
SAP historically has been long lead time to get new functionality out.
Yeah.
They are more of a kind of a traditional model in terms of how they deliver stuff to you. But we're coming to the point where even in SAP changes, we're doing that on a sprint basis.
Got it.
And so they start to see things come on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think that, again, if they have that confidence in you, you start delivering.
Yes.
Then the confidence builds on itself. And they know it's important. They also know it's not their strength.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you feel modern, you talk in terms of product as being the center of it, you kind of get that credibility. I will also say that hats off to Satya of saying this was a priority for us as a company.
Mm.
And Satya talks about it internally, about the importance of digital transformation for us internally.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get that air cover with your entire senior leadership team as well.
Got it. So kind of, if I was breaking out the layers, one of that executive leadership support report and vision for your role than you having your own vision, so people can see the full context of what you're working on and the priorities.
Right.
And then you had to become an agile and deliver, right? You couldn't say, yeah, I'll get back to you in a year with your requirement,
yeah.
but I have a sprint coming up, we'll slot it in just like a product team would
expect
of themselves.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is everybody in the team can act as a person promoting what you're trying to do as well. And so if you can get everybody on board to say, this is where we're going as an organization, we are fundamentally changing the nature of the organization, mm-hmm. then everybody becomes the biggest advocate for, oh, let me tell you what's going on.
Got it.
And the other people in the Microsoft example, they look and say, wow, you know, you're just another developer just like me, you just have a different product that you're building to me.
Yes.
And so you have to get that grassroots view as well. Mm. I will say that one thing that's been really important for our transformation, which we haven't talked about, is the culture, the old IT culture has to go as well.
Yeah.
This whole notion that I have my systems, I own my systems, I run my systems, and I, through the might of my voice, I am going to kind of push you into this is what we're going to do, that has to go away.
Okay.
It has to be replaced with the logic of your answer is the thing that drives every voice is heard.
Mm.
We spend a bunch of time saying, what is good hygiene in a meeting? Mm. How do you make sure that people who are more introverted actually get a voice?
Mm-hmm.
We spend a bunch of time at the end of meetings saying, has everybody had their opportunity? You don't have to do it in a way that feels like you're following a process. You basically look around and say, is there somebody else that's looking to say something here?
Yeah, that hasn't yet been heard.
Exactly. And so we a lot of the inclusiveness aspects can make its way into traditional IT as well.
Oh, that's fantastic to see.
Yeah.
Great. All right, we will open it up to questions that you might have. And there's a mic in the middle of the room, or we can pass it through too. There's other topics.
Yeah, you mentioned that you are funded internally by business units, I think you said. And just back to that, does that mean you, within those units you don't fund based on strategic initiatives? Whether you do, and if you do, and those strategic initiatives span a year boundary, do you fund multi-year and then revisit on the annual basis, or how does that work?
No, it's a great question. So we fund the whole pool, and we do not, underneath my organization, we do not have buckets until it's actually allocated based on our priorities to the different teams. We keep a list of the priority projects in order. Again, radical prioritization. This is the most important thing we're doing, followed by this, followed by this. And then we have a cut line. And we talk a lot about it's kind of, in the product teams, it was the last yes and the first no. And it's the exact same thing here. What's the last thing you chose to prioritize and what's to do and what's the first thing you chose not to? And we compare them across the different teams to make sure there's a consistency in the overall priorities and a certain level seems right, so you're not doing something that's really not that important over here versus the other. In terms of funding across years, Amy's made it really simple to me. She basically says, you're gonna be flat. And so basically, I know I've got, and she'll probably try to noodle it down even a little bit more than that, but usually I can defend myself to being largely flat. And it helps as all organizations kind of grow in size, your percentage of your spend actually goes down. So that's a good thing. But then we figure out, because there's always that cut line by group, a multi-year thing, we get it funded by saying, if it's high enough priority, it's one of the first things that gets funded. So that's how we end up working.
So you still revisit that though? On the,
we
on the
revisit that quarterly.
Oh, quarter.
Of saying, because again, things, it doesn't stop asks from coming in.
Right.
And asks come in and you have to say, where am I going to prioritize this in the list? The other thing I think is really critical is you have to be like, everybody in your leaders, all of your leaders have to be always on the lookout for wasted spend. Because the place that you get more capacity to spend is by finding the place that you're overspending today. And we have enough scale that it's been fairly easy to find that spend, but you'll get tighter and tighter. In a number of years, if we've got that all really well honed down, then it'll be harder. But right now, we've found a lot of that cruft that doesn't have to get spent.
Okay. One other quick question, is that okay? So you mentioned you're transitioning from sort of contract workers to a more full-time work for Microsoft employees.
Yep.
One of the challenges organizations have is that generally ends with a longer-term bloat in terms of benefits that are required and retirement, things like that.
Yep.
How do you justify sort of that longer-term 10, 20-year outcome when you're moving in that direction?
Yeah, we have an affectionate name for that. We call it the bow wave. And it is real. And Amy says we have to self-fund our bow wave.
Okay.
So we have to find efficiencies that will pay. And it's pretty substantial. But we have to find efficiencies that will pay it. As far as the 20-year thing, the shape of your organization kind of is self-healing, because people ultimately decide that they want to retire and enjoy, you know, some life not working. But you also have to look at what the curve looks like. And if you're not imagining and rebuilding your organization all the time, it can get much more heavy on people that are more senior. And there's lots of, look at my age, I'm hopefully delivering on the knee, on priorities. But you can get to the point where you have a lot of very high paid people, and you have to, again, university recruiting, building on that actually helps a bunch there, because it shifts your cost curve a little down towards that. It has a lot of benefits, including they're less expensive since they're earlier in career.
So generally hiring younger people helps with the bow wave.
But we self-fund our bow wave, and we use efficiency to self-fund.
And you're able to say short-term decreases this year are more than justified because of that curve that's happening moving ahead.
We take it a year at a time, right?
Okay.
Basically, Victor, my compadre on finance, tells me this is the bow wave you got to fund.
Yeah.
And then we find out where we're going to fund it.
Okay, thanks.
Sure, thanks.
Hi, Kurt.
Hey.
excuse me. I'm in a lead engineering role where frequently I'm not part of management, but I do have the ear of leadership. And one of the things that really stood out to me early in the conversation is more than just going to the stakeholders and asking, what do you need? Saying, you know, here's some options I've got for you.
Yep.
Do you have any sort of advice for someone in that position?
Not other than to say there is, I think it's in my blood to actually think in terms of everything kind of accruing to a product vision and where you want to take things. It's the only way I've, you know, in my whole history, it's the only way I've known to build things. And so we get in these meetings where people talk about, oh, we want to build this feature and this feature. And I'll actually just stand up in the meeting and go to the whiteboard and say, okay, tell me first, what's your aspiration for the customer? What is it we're trying to accomplish? And until you get anchored on that in a way that actually somebody's able to articulate it, then all that you're talking about is actually just, you know, blather in some sense. I need to be anchored on a very clear vision of what I'm trying to deliver, and then I get down into what's the productization plan that I have to deliver that. And I think as a lead developer, I don't know whether your structure so that you have program managers or product managers is similar. And we call program managers what most of the industry calls product managers. But the idea, the people that define what the product should be, don't let them be able to come at you with a litany of features. And if they do, and you like say, well, I don't understand how that composes to our overall priorities, have them prioritize it for you. Tell me where that fits in your relative priorities of what, or if you want to go even further saying, tell me how your set of features that you've demanded from me fit into some vision of where you want to take things. And so having tools like that to bring it all back to first principles, I tell people, I always try to step back until the problem doesn't change, my view of the problem doesn't change, because then I feel like I've got the whole thing on my sights. And until you can articulate what that overarching thing is, all the stuff underneath won't compose.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
I'm just curious, is there any precedent for using like a product development strategy to apply to a digital transformation? Or is that just, I mean, have any of your customers used that same kind of model? Or is it just because you're a product dev guy, like it made sense and it works?
I haven't heard anybody who truly did it just this way, but I'll bet there are. So I don't think that I've cornered. You could just say that Kurt only knows how to build products so that this just felt like a product opportunity. But I've been shocked at how well it actually composes really well, and it is exactly the same. You just have to change your lens a little bit. The one company, and I don't have a perfect view of everybody in the industry, the one company that I've had a long relationship with that thinks a bunch like this is Royal Dutch Shell. Because those guys say they actually have a different team in IT that is all about what's our vision for where we're going longer term in terms of our IT investments. That's probably the team that's been closest. It's interesting, it mirrors their whole business, because the other thing they do is they actually, in an incredibly difficult industry like oil and gas, they say, where is the world going in oil and gas moving forward? And they actually make bets many years out that say, we believe it's moving from, and they're not massive things, except for they align the whole company around it, of saying we think fossil fuels are gonna go away over a period of time. And imagine an oil and gas company saying that as a primary premise mm-hmm. of what they do, and then saying, so the investments we need to make that will keep Royal Dutch Shell relevant look like this. And so I think they probably, since they're very vision-led, they then drive it down to their teams as well. I'll also tell you, actually getting crisp on the definition of a vision is really, really hard. I was talking to one of the teams just this week of saying, and I felt bad about saying it, but I said, you realize what you've defined there is a mission, not a vision. Because what they end up wanting to talk about is we're going to build the most agile, up-to-date financial transaction, set of services, et cetera, so that we can create the most agile experience for our sellers. So that actually, you didn't say in any of that what you want to build, and the vision should be what you want to build. And so it's hard, and this gets down to the people involved as well. You have to, they weren't typically used to thinking as a product team. And so there's a different mindset that has to come out of it as well.
Cool, thank you.
Thanks.
I think we have 1 minute if there's a last quick question. We can race to the mic.
We'll take two.
So you mentioned that you lead across the top and try to drive kind of consistencies. I guess my question is, how do you drive reuse and consistency across a huge organization without demanding thou must do this and be able to kind of allow your team to own their own destiny? So kind of how do you guys drive reuse and basically ability to kind of control your own destiny as a development team?
I don't know how much. Well, it's interesting. For us, the biggest thing has been getting to an architecture that makes sense. And so what we try to do is say, looking forward, what is our data architecture? How do I think about the relationship? One of the big initiatives we have is a customer 360. Which says that we should be able to, within this modern end-to-end digital system, we should be able to tell our sellers or tell our customers and our partners every shred of information relevant for them to be better at delivering to the customer value. And the only way you're going to be able to do that is to have a very consistent master data strategy followed by a catalog of what data exists where, a structure for how you're going to create an Azure data lake that you're going to do machine learning on, and have that be a platform that everybody bets on. And so there's a bunch of it that says, if you get the architecture right, then it's very clear when you're doing something that's off strategy or that is duplicative. The second thing we've tried to do, and we're just doing it now, this transition is not done for us by a long shot, but we're doing a list of saying every place we make an architectural, or we make a product investment, is it first party, is it bespoke, or is it third party? And places where, for us in particular, there are places where it's in conflict, where we do a little bit of it bespoke, and we do a little bit first party and a little bit of it third party. And we say, and then for instance, in HR systems, we're having the team actually lay out from the point where somebody's interested in joining Microsoft through recruiting, through onboarding, through HR management and learning and promotion, et cetera, all the way to offboarding when they retire. What are the systems that we use across that entire channel? And what's the architecture across all of them? What is our strategy about first party versus third party versus bespoke? And so I think what happens is you bring things together, the more they make logical sense, the more you can ferret out the places where there's inconsistency.
Who sets that strategy? Is that really high up? Is that the team's up? Where does that strategy come from? It's like, yeah, it makes sense to have the dots end to end.
Yeah. I try not to set the strategy per se. I try to ask the questions that say, do we have a strategy? Do I understand the strategy? But I push on the particular team to set the strategy. And then they have to rationalize, like with the Dynamics guys, what their piece of the puzzle is. Dynamics is an example. Yeah.
Hi, Kurt. Can you talk through how the disciplines and roles in engineering have changed over the last 3 to 5 years from on-premise to the cloud? Because I know Microsoft has gone through a large change in how you guys do engineering disciplines, dev, test. We used to, have a lot of different
stuff.
The
biggest thing we've done is moved away from test as its own discipline much more. I don't know whether it's cloud per se. I think it's much more around going to agile development, going towards developers and development teams actually doing their own test. That actually has been the primary thing. We're also working with the SRE discipline inside of my team of saying, what does a systems reliability effort or services reliability effort look like? That's been a big change as well. But I think that's probably been the biggest thing. In my team in particular, in particular traditional IT, the role of user design has escalated a huge amount as that place that if you get it right from the beginning, it tends to stay right all the way through. Data. Those are probably the big things that have changed. But that'd be a long discussion to have. It's a good one, though.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your insights and your wisdom. And thanks to all you. Hope we got some good information.